Hey, folks, you're listening to the free version of the Ring of Fire Radio podcast. This week, or I should say last week, we were in Las Vegas, Nevada for the Mass Torts Made Perfect conference, basically where the country's top plaintiff attorneys get together and learn best practices, no pun intended, about how to take on some of the most malignant corporations in the country. And I had the opportunity to sit down with about three or four of them and talk about the cases they've been working on. Some of these stories are pretty harrowing. And if you're not listening to all of it because you're just listening to the free podcast, you don't know what you're missing. Check it out. Go to rofpodcast.com. Sign up for the full show. It's just a couple of bucks a month. And you will get access not only to the full show on a weekly basis, but all our archive shows. You can go back to some of the other conference shows we've done, some fascinating stories. And, of course, we've got years and years worth of other guests that are fascinating as well. So check it out, rofpodcast.com. We need your support, and that's where you can do it. Welcome to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Yes, we survived our trip to Las Vegas, Nevada, and on today's show, we'll have interviews from the Mass Torts Made Perfect 2018 conference, the largest plaintiff attorney seminar in the country. Attorney Brian Witzer will tell us an amazing legal battle he is facing after helping a 15-year-old boy whose body began to blister and burn after taking Motrin. Jessica Pride will explain why the Me Too movement has emboldened women to speak out against sexual harassment in the workplace and why she devotes her time to helping those affected. Human rights attorney Gavi Marone will join us to discuss why he sued a German company for its involvement in making chemical weapons for Saddam Hussein. And Heather Digby Parton from Salon.com will be here to break down the biggest news stories of the week. And finally, we'll hear from a former tobacco defense lawyer, Bethany Schneider, on why she made the switch to protect consumers from protecting big corporations. Don't forget, you can go to rofpodcast.com and sign up for the free one-hour version of Ring of Fire Radio podcast. And if you want the full show without commercials, become a member. That's the best way to support this program. That's rofpodcast.com. Here to help me analyze some of the biggest news stories of the week, Heather Parton from Salon, or as you may know her from her Uber blog, Hullabaloo, Digby. So, Heather, obviously a tremendous amount of news this week, other weeks. We are in the wake of the attack on Syria, which fortunately appears to have been rather modest and contained, as far as we know, no loss of life, which I'm happy about. I would prefer no attack, but just basically lobbing a couple of missiles into the Mediterranean and everybody walking away with them all having bragging rights seems like a relatively good outcome. And of course, the story that still unwinding from last week was the revelation that there were Michael Cohen, the President Trump's personal attorney, in testimony revolving around Stormy Daniels' case, revealed that his third client of the past 2 years, after Donald Trump and a major Republican donor, was in fact Sean Hannity, of all people. Give me your first reaction.
Well, my first reaction was to, you know, high five my husband. We both kind of did a little, you know, dance in the middle of the living room upon hearing it. It was one of the few moments in the last year or so that I've actually had a moment of pure joy at hearing. And in fact, I don't know if you saw the Stephen Colbert reaction that night. I think it was on Monday night of this past week. But it's hilarious. You should go to YouTube and watch it, because you can imagine after all the years that he spent and Jon Stewart spent on The Daily Show also, you know, skewering Hannity, nothing could be more satisfying to them and to me, to be honest. I mean, it was an amazing thing because, there's a lot to sort out in that whole story, and I'm not sure we even have touched the surface of it as right. of yet. But, you know, the fact is that, I mean, what we know up to now is that the feds have been tracking and have been looking into Cohen's businesses for months, apparently. Some of this apparently came from a referral from Mueller, but clearly there's a whole bunch of other stuff here. Now, we don't know yet whether or not Mueller uncovered this stuff in the course of his investigation of Russia. And by the way, Cohen's involved in that stuff, too. It's not yep. this particular case, but he is involved because Mueller, there are numerous reports of him interrogating witnesses with some very serious, you know, subpoenas and requirements that they test, grand jury subpoenas, that they talk about Cohen's involvement in these overseas deals, which does not appear to be part of the Southern District of New York case, which is about Cohen and his taxi medallions. And we are assuming a lot of it has to do with the Stormy Daniels and Karen McDougal and various other hush money schemes that he and Donald Trump and at least one other client, which is a man named, I think it's Elliot Broidy, right. Who's a big RNC Trump donor and RNC finance chairman, who he also arranged a payoff to a Playboy playmate of. And then there is Sean Hannity. And when they went to court on Monday, it was because they were claiming this big, you know, sweeping attorney-client privilege on the previous Friday when they first went to court. And the judge is going, well, and, you know, the U.S. attorney had said, well, look, this isn't really about his legal work. This is about some business deals that he did. And they were saying, no, there's all this information about my clients. And the judge said, well, how many clients do you have, and who are they? And they said, well, we can't really answer because Michael Cohen at the time was out hanging with his Goombas on the street corner smoking cigars and didn't bother to come to court. So she said, all right, bring your client in on Monday, and I want to know who these people are, what his clients are. I need to know about that before I can make a ruling about attorney-client privilege. They come in on Monday, say, well, he's got three clients. Everybody's going, three? Okay. And we know about the two, right? Donald Trump and this guy, Elliot Broidy. That was public knowledge. Who's the third? And the guy said, well, the lawyer says, well, we didn't really, this person doesn't want to be named, has said explicitly that he does not want to be named publicly. And the judge goes, no, I don't think so. You're going to tell me. And he did. Well, and
no, wait a second. There's one other interim step, which I think also captures Michael Cohen and all of these guys perfectly. The Cohen's lawyer said, well, we'll tell you, but we just want to make sure that Michael Cohen's not going to be disbarred for being unethical by naming this client after the client has said, don't name me. And the judge said, no, you're fine because I'm ordering you to tell me.
Right.
And the guy's like, oh, okay, Sean Hannity. And
all
that was
right.
it.
Yeah, it's Sean Hannity. Yeah.
Yeah, as long as we're not going to pay a price, sure, I got no problem throwing him under the bus.
Exactly. Yeah, we'll throw him under the bus. Not a problem at all. Well,
and then
nobody knows what this is about, right? I mean, what he was representing Sean Hannity. But, of course, the first suspicion that comes to your mind is, what if Michael Cohen appeared to be specializing in at this point?
Right.
And it appears to be, he's paying off.
Two-thirds of my clients I pay off. I pay off adult actresses to not report the fact that they've had affairs. And then one-third I just do some advising on real estate transactions.
Right. And, of course, because Sean Hannity, he's worth over $80 million. He has his own private jet. He can't afford to get a real estate attorney. So he has to, hire Michael Cohen. The man who went to the worst law school in the country and clearly is not the sharpest tool in this shed because, by the way, we find out in the course of this whole thing that he's been recording conversations, for crying out loud, I mean, this is a guy who's claiming attorney-client privilege, but he recorded his clients.
You do gotta wonder. I mean, you know, that part about Hannity having the money, like, if Michael Cohen had advice that was worthwhile, why wouldn't Hannity have hired him as his attorney? I mean, what? There was clearly something about the relationship that they wanted to keep super secret, and there must have been some illicit part about it. And I have a feeling we're going to find out sooner than later. And it is fascinating. When we come back, let's talk a little bit more about Michael Cohen and who he is. And then I guess we got to move on to the other big story who's in the same sort of orbit, and that's James Comey. And of course, there was... he was all over the place this week.
Yep.
We got to take a quick break. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. We'll be right back with the great Digby, Heather Parton, after this. Hey, folks. Mike Papantonio's new book entitled Law and Vengeance, which is the follow-up to his critically acclaimed novel Law and Disorder, is finally out and available to you to buy. The book is a legal and political thriller drawing on Pap's experience both as a skilled trial lawyer and as a nationally syndicated political talk show host. The story follows trial lawyer Gina Romano, who was first introduced in Law and Disorder, on her quest for both vengeance and justice in a whistleblower lawsuit against a weapons manufacturer who developed and sold a dangerously defective rifle scope. Papp has built a story around real-life events that he's encountered as one of the top trial lawyers in America, where he's been fighting some of the world's largest and most corrupt corporations. Buy Mike Papantonio's new book, Law and Vengeance, today. Go to www.lawandvengeance.com. That's lawandvengeance.com. Check it out. I know you're going to love it. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar, here with Heather Digby Parton from Salon. So, Heather, when we broke, we were talking about the beginning of the week, the sort of the startling revelation that Michael Cohen had three clients, one of whom was Donald Trump, one of whom was a friend of Donald Trump who was also a big Republican donor. And we should remind people that Michael Cohen was like, what, vice chair of the RNC fundraising?
Right.
And the third client was Sean Hannity. Sean Hannity on his radio program and his TV show was like, I don't understand why people are so focused on this. What's the big deal here? And then saying like, of course I had client privilege with him. Maybe I gave him $10, which is, you know, that's not strange. You're a multimillionaire. You're developing enough of a relationship with an attorney that you would just, there's $10 so that we can have client attorney client privilege. That is, incidentally, my understanding is an old mob trick, although my understanding is also you don't need to give money, but that sort of, I guess, is one more piece of evidence that you should have that relationship. And for whatever reason, Sean Hannity doesn't say like, well, maybe I'll throw you, you know, I don't know, $40,000. You'll be one of my attorneys on retainer. That doesn't happen. So clearly there's more to that story. We should also say that in terms of like Michael Cohen, there was some reporting this week by Josh Marshall that Michael Cohen, through his uncle, owned a part of a social club called El Caribe Social Club. This was out, I think, in parts of Brooklyn. It's a Brooklyn social club. It was a well-known meeting spot for members of the Italian and Russian organized crime families in the 70s and 80s. But it also turns out to have been a headquarters of Russian organized crime currently, and through the 90s at least, and that Michael Cohen owned a piece of this until the day that he gave up his stake, the day that President Trump was elected. which is a coincidental time to do it and weird. I mean, you own part of a social club. Why not? Just keep it. I mean, what possible reason would you want to divest yourself of that when your number one client is getting a lot more scrutiny? We'll never know, I guess. Or maybe we will know. But, I mean, I've speculated for a long time before we get to Comey. I've speculated for a long time, and apparently Cohen's a longtime friend of Felix Sater, who is a, it's clear now, was a CIA and FBI asset. In what exactly? Some of it was counterterrorism, you know, which could be tracking arms sales through organized crime, et cetera, and other things. It does seem, and I've speculated for a long time, that, you know, you had Donald Trump basically involving himself with the mafia, with the Russian mob, perhaps, and not understanding that when he asked his friend Boris to go, you know, the guy who he knows is stealing credit card numbers, to go and maybe do some data crunching, that he was actually talking to a potential person who works for Russian intelligence agencies or whatnot. I mean, but it's quite clear that Donald Trump is very concerned about Michael Cohen. And last week they pardoned Scooter Libby as a way of sort of saying, look what I can do. But it's fascinating, the tentacles on this thing. And I think we're still very much at the surface.
Well, I do, too. And, you know, I mean, Trump himself, I mean, I think Cohen came to work for him in, what, 2006, I think. So he's been with him for more than a decade. And they, by all accounts, have been very closely aligned on a number of things. And Cohen, as I mentioned earlier, has been involved in some of this overseas stuff, too. I mean, he was the guy who was setting up the Moscow Trump Tower. There's a deal in Azerbaijan with the Iranian Revolutionary Guard. There's one in Indonesia that's all just dirty money all the way. They're doing a big investigation down in Brazil. And Cohen was involved in a lot of this stuff. And some of this has to do with, I think, I mean, I don't have any proof of this, but it seems like there's an international money laundering component here that would be reasonable to assume might have something to do with all this Ukrainian connection, Russian mob, et cetera, et cetera. So I would assume that's where Mueller's investigation on that side is going. Now, what's happening here in the U.S., obviously the U.S. attorney from the Southern District of New York is going to have some very, very strong leverage against Michael Cohen here, it appears. So we'll see. And, you know, they can work in tandem. I mean, that's not something that they can have leverage over Cohen in the one case in order to talk about the other case. Let's just put it that way.
Yep.
So, I mean, and Trump himself has been, you know, the Taj Mahal, by the way, as recently as 2015, was fined the highest fine in history for a casino in the United States for money laundering violations. They were routinely laundering money through that hotel when Trump was owning it and afterwards. And in fact, it was known back in the 90s as the hangout for the Russian mob. They'd go down there to Atlantic City. They were running huge sums of money through that casino, and they were being fined. The casino was being fined for it all the time, but, you know, they just paid the fine, right? I mean, that was just how the whole situation
cost
worked.
Cost of doing business.
Yeah. I mean, this is now, you know, I just want to say one thing before you move on to another subject. Imagine the hubris of a man like Donald Trump thinking that none of this was going to come out, and so he's going to run for president, and, you know, with the most, the brightest spotlight on the planet is on that particular person, right? I mean, there is nothing more. Well, now, granted, he assumed he was going to take a lot of power along with that, but what kind of a person with these shady dealings would decide that he's going to become president?
Well, I'll tell you,
we
only have 30 seconds, but let me give you my quick answer. One is, I don't think he ever thought he was going to win, and I think they all thought that they would escape any type of scrutiny in a perfect sort of producers, and I'm talking about the play in the movie now, scenario where we can take 600% of the money for the financing for the play, but if it goes out of business, everybody loses their money. We don't have to account to anybody. And I also think that Felix Sater, who was clearly connected to the New York FBI office, I think there's a Whitey Bulger aspect to this, and I have a feeling a lot of these guys thought that they were completely protected. But we have to take a break. Yeah. Digby will be back with more in the next hour. Stick around with me because we got a lot to talk about. Coming up, human rights attorney Gabby Marone will explain how a German company ended up helping Saddam Hussein's chemical weapons program. I'm Sam Cedar. We'll be right back on Ring of Fire Radio.
I'm a trial lawyer. I've spent countless hours poring through documents that tell the story about the ugliest side of corporate America. Corporate media refuses to talk about these issues.
The conduct by this company was deplorable.
I'm going to paint a clear picture about how disturbing, how corrupt corporate conduct has become in modern America. These are stories that no one else can tell. I'm Mike Papantonio, host of America's Lawyer. Question more.
Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Our next interview from the Mass Torts Made Perfect, a plaintiffs-only legal conference put together by our own Mike Papantonio and his law firm, Levin Papantonio. Pap is teaming up with Gabby Marone to hold banks and corporations accountable when they finance or support terrorism. Here to tell us the story of how a German corporation helped Saddam Hussein build his chemical weapon plants is human rights attorney Gabby Marone. Continuing our coverage at Mass Torts Conference 2018, I'm with Gabby Marone, who is an international human rights attorney, and you specialize in tracking financing of terrorist activities, and you have now filed a suit against a company that was involved in providing Saddam Hussein with the material support to essentially commit an act of genocide against the Kurds in the north through chemical warfare, and to some extent Iran in the context of the Iraq-Iran war. So, all right, tell us who are the defendants in this case?
Okay, so we've actually alleged that seven European companies and 15 individuals conspired with the Saddam regime to commit genocide, which is a heavy allegation. And it's more than just providing material support. The primary defendant is the largest tourism company in the world, which in those days was a huge West German conglomerate called Prusag, which changed its name to TUI, T-U-I. And they were in the business of steel, of equipment manufacturing, and of chemicals. And TUI met with members of Iraqi military intelligence and agreed to take their chief lawyer, a guy named Salah Majid, who didn't speak a word of English, who happened to be married to a German woman, knew English, but he's an Iraqi lawyer, and they brought him to Hanover, Germany in 1980, and we've interviewed him, and so on. He claims that he was hired to be the chief lawyer for international tenders for this giant conglomerate without speaking a word of German. And he worked there until the day that the Saddam regime was toppled and still doesn't speak German. And that he claimed that the reason he was given the job was because German lawyers don't know how to speak English. And he was, in fact, the mole or the cover given to him by TUI to organize the entire weapons procurement program for Iraq clandestinely in Europe. He told us that he, even though he was the chief lawyer for tenders for TUI, he was allowed to work at the same time for TUI's competitors in helping them do tenders. So there's no question he was really working for Saddam Hussein. And they put together a plan with multiple companies to build the entire chemical weapons facilities in Iraq, which became the largest chemical weapon plants in the world during the Cold War in Iraq, during a time of sanctions also. And most of the companies that were major participants came from West Germany. So, for instance, we have copies of letters and emails that one West German company writes to another named Heuberger, and they say, okay, we've been contracted to build the, quote, pesticide, quote, factory, which we know is what they call devil's kitchen. And they labeled the buildings as bunkers because they were built underground. In fact, they built seven factories and labs, and then they built what they called seven dummy buildings above ground. This whole plant was outside of Samara in the middle of the desert on a military base with machine guns on every building, tanks, and surface-to-air missiles surrounding the entire complex. Typical factory, right? And all the buildings were built underground with 1 meter thick reinforced concrete roofs and 2 meters of hardened clay above it to protect from air bombardment. The buildings were empty shells so that if someone tried to bomb the pesticide plants, they would hit the empty buildings. So the point here is there was absolutely no question they were building chemical weapons factories and not pesticide plants.
In fact, the initial plans were tendered to an American company, you told
Correct.
Me. So just tell that story as further evidence that there was a it was unreasonable for this German conglomerate to not understand what they were doing.
Right. Exactly correct. There's a company called Pufuder. It's hard to pronounce. It's P-F-U-D-E-R. And in 1975, the Saddam regime approached this company through the Ministry of Agriculture in Iraq, saying they want to build a pesticide plant. And so they sent two of their engineers out to Iraq to see the site, and they drew up blueprints of what a pesticide plant would normally look like. And then the Ministry of Agriculture requested some modifications and enlargements. When the management in America saw what the modifications were, they immediately washed their hands of the project and withdrew. Then, a year later, these plans appeared in a company in England called Imperial Enterprises, and with the same request to continue on with the specs and plans. And not only did they refuse, but they contacted a British intelligence, and that was reported in the Washington Post, that this could be used for chemical weapons. And so then Iraq stepped back, and they reorganized everything under the Ministry of Technology and Weapons called SOTI. It was run by military intelligence. And all the contracting from this point on goes between these companies and military intelligence in Iraq.
But still, supposedly about agricultural products.
Right. So the code name for the project was Project 922, and they labeled it as pesticide plants. And there was over 100 German engineers during the years that were on site. Each one of the German companies that are defendants had offices in Baghdad. So they absolutely knew what it is. Military intelligence officials were constantly at their offices. And we have that from testimony and interviews, because in the 90s, some of these people were prosecuted in Germany for illegal export of weapons, without saying chemical weapons, but that was all they exported. They all testified, for instance, they were on the base. They never saw anything. They were only there on days that nothing was being produced, that there was never one drop of pesticide ever produced in this base, in these plants. One of the things that they were requested to do is you would have air circulation in factories, especially where you're dealing with pesticide. And normally the standard was that you would replace the entire atmosphere of the factory, you know, once every 5 minutes, 10 minutes, something like
that.
So
the airflow is such that you have fresh air going through.
So they installed air handlers that every 30 seconds replace the entire air, which is much, you're dealing with toxins that are totally not like pesticide.
Right.
They also built what they called in German an, quote, inhalation chamber. Cute. It was a gas chamber. This was to test the, quote, pesticide. And if you were thinking, okay, what are pests for pesticide, it would be like little tiny bugs or something like this. So how big of an inhalation gas chamber would you need? You can think about it. It would fit on this table. It was 3 meters by 3 meters by 2 meters, large enough to fit donkeys. And we have evidence that they started out testing it with dogs, then donkeys, then Iranian prisoners of war were tested in it. And then they built a what they called an incinerator, which you can think of today's Holocaust Remembrance Day. You can think of the ovens in Auschwitz to go ahead and incinerate the carcasses after they killed them in the gas chamber. And this is, again, a West German companies did this. So it's just astounding.
All right, Gavi Marone, we're going to take a break. When we come back, I want to talk about who the plaintiffs are in this case. And just get a sense of time. And then ultimately, you know, what happened to these facilities? I mean, obviously, the arguments of the Iraq War were that the Saddam Hussein regime had weapons of mass destruction. We'll talk about that. And obviously, they weren't made up from whole cloth. But the question was, did they still have them in 2003 when the United States invaded? All right, we're going to take a quick break. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. We'll be right back. Folks, the Ring of Fire is sponsored by JustCoffee.coop. That's JustCoffee.coop. If you like fair trade, delicious coffee, tea, or chocolate, head over to JustCoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MAJORITY and get 10% off. There's free shipping. You have no reason not to get this great coffee. It's a great outfit in Madison, Wisconsin, which supported the protests there. JustCoffee.coop. We're back on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar, continuing the coverage of the Mass Torts Made Perfect conference in Las Vegas, Nevada. We return to my interview with Gavi Marone, who is telling us the story of a German corporation which helped Saddam Hussein build chemical weapons factories, which was used in genocide against the Kurdish people. Here's that now. Continuing our coverage at the 2018 Mass Torts Conference, I'm here with Gavi Marone. He is an international human rights lawyer who much of his work, and we've talked in the past about your pursuit of terrorism financing through banks and corporations, most often than not oil companies. But you have filed a case against a German corporation that the claim is that they knowingly helped Saddam Hussein build facilities for chemical weapons that were used in genocide of Kurds in the north of Iraq, as well as during the Iran-Iraq war. So you told us in the last segment how clearly obvious it was that the German corporation had been contracted to build not a pesticide facility, but rather a chemical weapons facility. Who are the plaintiffs in this case?
So we have approximately 4,000 plaintiffs. 3,000 of them actually were killed by the weapons, the estates of 3,000 people, and roughly 1,000 surviving family members, many of which are injured. All of the injured are dying. They've lived horrible lives where they had 10 to 20% of their lung capacity. The rest, they were blinded by the mustard gas. It depends how serious they were injured by which gas, because cocktails were used of different gases on Halabja and 400 other villages across the Kurdish region. And if you were harmed by mustard gas is a blistering agent, which also destroys your lungs and blinds you, destroys your cataracts. But many times you could survive, but then whatever's left of your life is in pain every moment. Nerve gas kills you very rapidly, and two nerve gases were used, sarin and tabun. Sarin is the same nerve gas that the Assad regime used last week in Damascus. And if you survive the nerve gas, you actually recover. And so of the roughly 900 and something surviving family members, we still have 143, we had 144 2 weeks ago, who were mustard gas victims, and they're suffering horrible, painful lives. and the rest of them were nerve gas victims, or a few of them weren't there in the day of the attack. And so they've just lost, like, for instance, one client is the sole surviving son, and he lost 17 brothers, sisters, parents, and so on.
And this is taking place during, essentially, from 83 to 89, I believe?
That's when, yes, the plants were started to be built in 81. Starting in 83, it was documented by the United Nations Secretary General and UN reports every 6 months, that, and then numerous media reports, that Iraq was using chemical weapons on Iranian soldiers. They also did two giant massacres against the Kurds, not with chemical weapons, but they slaughtered thousands of Kurds in those massacres. In 1987, they started using chemical weapons against their own Kurds, I mean Iraqi citizens, through 88. Chemical weapons were a key in a genocide, a key component of a genocide in which 180,000 Kurds were killed during this time. And what the Iraqi army did was, because the Kurds are in the mountains in all kinds of villages, as you saw how long it took to defeat ISIS, it would have taken them years to try to go village by village. What they wanted to do is to kill every living thing in a strip from one side to the other, the entire Kurdish region. And we've got copies of the orders, every living thing, all animals, plants, and humans. And so what they would do is they would surround an area with a number of villages with the army on the roads, and then they would bombard for 2 days with chemical weapons the villages. Everyone would flee into the waiting arms of the troops. Then they would be boarded. They would be taken on trucks and buses. And normally the men and the women were separated. By men, we mean 10-year-old boys until 70-year-old men. Those were all then machine-gunned into trenches and killed in the desert. And the women were put into concentration camps and later what they were called resettlement villages. So they basically lived a life with no men. So during the first 7 months of the slaughter, that's how they did it. The last 2 months, they killed the women and girls and everybody.
So what happened to these facilities and to the what was manufactured there? By 2003, it was quite clear that there was no major caches of of this material. What happened to it?
So as part of the ceasefire in the first Gulf War in 91, Iraq committed, under UN supervision, with the United States had a big presence in, the destruction of all of its chemical weapons stockpiles and facilities and biological weapons, and if there was any nuclear. So for the next months, base by base, building by building, they were all destroyed, and the chemical weapons were all taken, and they were neutralized. And more or less, that was complete. And the Iraqi regime was required to report to the United Nations how it obtained all the materials and from whence, and a description, which is a good part of our evidence.
Okay, that's what I was going to ask. I mean, I would imagine at that point, as it's being dismantled, the United Nations is logging, like, where did this stuff come from? What were the means in which it was made?
Exactly, and Iraq was required to disclose. They never disclosed 100% of everything. So theoretically, all of the chemical weapons then were destroyed, and all of the chemical weapons plants destroyed. So we saw in Syria recently that supposedly all the chemical weapons were exported out of Syria, but then somehow they have some again. So prior to the Second Gulf War, I guess, the United States figured that there must be more chemical weapons, or they must have rebuilt them, or, you know, and that's what they publicly stated was the reason for that war. And we know that they never found any more weapons of mass destruction.
Okay, we have just about a minute and a half left. How is it that in 1992, let's say, around that time, the UN is logging this material and presumably with whatever type of machinery or technology, and, you know, it's not like this stuff is made in everybody's backyard. Pretty clear where, at least some sense, how is it this material has been sitting there for almost 40 years? Or I guess, 20 years, 20, 25 years.
And no, the materials were all destroyed.
No, but I'm saying the information.
The documents.
Yes, the documents. We just have about a minute left. I mean, how is it that this is only happening now?
Who else? First of all, you're talking about poor people who are scattered amongst villages. out in Kurdistan with no access to lawyers that would do something. So who went there? I mean, I happened to go there, and since 2005, been going to Iraq back and forth, open offices there. This is a huge investment of time and money to do it. Who else reached out to them? So, and why did no one else do it? The only thing I can mention is that the trials of Saddam Hussein and Chemical Ali and all those after the liberation of Iraq, right? The law that set up the court to do it had a specific provision that you could only bring to trial individuals and not companies. Why that law said that?
Who set that law up?
Well,
the CPA?
The Iraqi government, but of course during the time that... So I mean, I don't know. I can just speculate. But from my perspective, what we have is, forgetting about the politics of it all, which I'm really not focused on,
right,
is that here we have corporate greed, willing to make money on the death and suffering of people, you know, and being with impunity and never once ever being held accountable. And that's what we're trying to change.
Gavi Marone, thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it. When we come back, Heather Digby Parton will join us to analyze more news from the past week. That's just ahead. I'm Sam Cedar. You're listening to Ring of Fire Radio. Don't forget, ROFpodcast.com to help support this program.